Hello, and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday, the 3rd of April. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Coming up this week, have you seen the Oscar-winning film The King's Speech? If so, did you know that one part of King George's great speech to unify the empire at the start of World War II was actually missing from the film? That was a poem written by a local Warmley resident, and Tony Gosling finds out more about that.
Indeed. Looking out across the Atlantic with a Central American theme, we have a guest in to talk about US intervention in Nicaragua. And we have the second part of our interview about El Salvador.
Also, local original music, we have Welsh singer Nikki Stitch, who's here to tell us about her influences and sing for us. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 FM, Preston on Preston FM, and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join us, contact Volunteering Bristol. That's just off Queen Square in Bristol. Have you seen the Oscar-winning film The King's Speech yet? I have. It's pretty good. I can recommend. If so, I bet you didn't know that one of the most important parts of King George's broadcast to unify the empire at the start of World War II was actually missing from the film. And that was a stirring poem written by a local Warmley resident.
Hi, I'm Alan Bryant from Kingswood Heritage Museum. I'd like to tell you another story that would be fairly relevant to the Oscars this year. Part of the King's Speech was omitted from the actual film. And it was a very famous part in the 1940s and evermore, was regarding the story of the lost poetess who had written the poem that was read by the King to the Empire on Christmas Day 1939. And the poem was called God Knows. Now, nobody really knew who the original authoress was, but after current research, it appears that the Queen Mother had been given a Christmas card the year before with the words on. It just said it was an anonymous author. Anyway, the story begins back in 1906, when Minnie Haskins, who lived in Warmley House, wrote this poem. With other poems, it was produced into a little booklet to raise funds for a charity campaign in India called The Desert, and it was one of the poems from there. The Desert was the name of the book. It was for missionary work in India. The following year, somebody copied out that poem and sent it to the minister from Bristol Baptist Church, and then it was forgotten about. In 1938, somebody sent one to the Queen Mother, who then showed it to the King for his broadcast. He thought that was the most appropriate part. And bear in mind that he still had his stammer. So not only did he have to speak to the nation, he had to read a poem as well. Anyway, Christmas Day, 1939, Minnie Haskins was in East Sussex, actually with her grandson, and heard the poem. But I think it was the Times of that day, was then saying, well, who wrote this poem? Who was this anonymous poet? And eventually it was traced back to Minnie Haskins. So then she had an element of celebrity herself then. In 1951, in the Festival of Britain, she returned to Warmley, the house that she wrote the poem in, Warmley House, and unveiled a plaque as part of the local council's celebrations of the Festival of Britain. When the King died, there's a plaque on St. George's Mausoleum at Windsor with the words on. The poem was also used when the Queen Mother died recently. And that's really the bit that they've missed out on the film. It might have got an extra Oscar if they added that bit in as well.
Now, what about the poem itself?
The poem is called God Knows, and it starts. It's a very long poem, but I'll just do the first little bit. I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, "Give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown." And he replied, "Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than the known way."
And I suppose that was quite poignant in Christmas 1939.
Exactly. And that was broadcast all around the world to the Empire. The King chose that poem to unify and give the Empire, as it was then, because it was Commonwealth afterward, give the Empire a sense of unity And you know, it was a very frightening period.
And why, may you think, did the King's Speech filmmakers decide to drop one of the most important parts of King George's Christmas 1939 speech from the film? Why, indeed? Maybe if there's ever a remake, they will include the local poetess's work, which was felt the best way at the outbreak of World War II to bring together people from all over the world to resist the Nazis. And we'll be hearing the whole of that poem at the end of the show.
Well, to discuss Nicaragua, it's my pleasure to introduce into the studio an American by the name of Jessica Randall. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. So how long have you been in the UK?
I've been in the UK since January, actually, working with the Bristol Link with Nicaragua, or Blink. It's okay. A charity that has a friendship agreement with the town of Puerto Morazan in northwest of Nicaragua.
Right. So how did you find out about Blink from America? Where are you from in America?
I'm from Connecticut, right by New York.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you're studying there?
Yeah, I'm studying there, and I was studying there in Connecticut, and I'm just got accepted into an MPhil program in Latin American Studies at Oxford.
Yeah.
So coming over here and kind of got involved in a charity to kind of pad out my experience while I'm in the UK studying at Oxford.
Okay, so what's your field of study? I mean, obviously sort of geopolitics.
It's Latin American studies and Spanish, and I have a focus on gender and development.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. So where exactly is Nicaragua for the uninitiated?
Nicaragua is in Central America, closer to South America than to Mexico, located between Honduras and Costa Rica.
Okay, is there any particular reason you're interested in that?
When I was in my final year of my undergraduate at Fairfield University, I took a course on Nicaragua specifically and wound up traveling to Nicaragua for about a month to do primary research for my senior thesis on how the Sandinista Revolution acted as a vehicle for the development of women's civil society in Nicaragua.
Okay. Interesting. So tell us a little bit about the charity that you're working for.
Okay. Well, Blink is a charity located in Bristol, and Bristol has a friendship agreement with Puerto Morazan, as I said. And we do a lot of education, healthcare projects. We fund and send resources for Montessori-styled education to schools, focus on building more preschools, building latrines for the community, things like that. We finance a women's shrimp farming cooperative.
Okay.
Wide range.
I suppose a lot of British people, when they think about US involvement in Nicaragua, is the words death squad immediately spring to mind, quite infamously, and some of their interest in Central America in particular has been criticised as being involved possibly with lots of cocaine smuggling and all sorts of stuff. So this, you know, that's like a massive minefield to tread way across, you know, particularly as an American. What was your first sort of, you know, when you're reading about all of this, what was your reaction to it?
Like you said, it's kind of a mix of shock and, I don't know, resignation in a sense, because you don't, I don't know, kind of growing up, you don't really hear about anything like this in the U.S. And it's only until I actually took a course on Nicaragua that I was kind of exposed to the U.S. involvement in Central America and how almost dire the political situation was there at the hands of the United States and the facilitation of the United States.
What is the status of Nicaragua at the moment? Because obviously we're assuming in a lot of these places that, you know, the elections are rigged or a dictatorship or...
Right. Well, currently, Daniel Ortega is the president of Nicaragua, and he was elected in 2006 in what some consider to be a fraudulent election. There was no election observation in 2006, any in kind of international election observation. And so a lot of ballots were considered to be kind of torn up or burned. And in that way, Ortega wound up winning the presidency, some claim. Now, again, this year in November are another round of presidential elections. And according to the Nicaraguan constitution, the president is only allowed to serve for 1 5-year term. You're not allowed two consecutive terms. So he could finish his term, wait 5 years, and then become reelected. Right. But since he controls the Supreme Court as well, the Supreme Court has just overturned that article in the Constitution to say that a president cannot run for two consecutive terms. And so Ortega is running for another 5 years. The elections, like I said, are in 2011. And right now he's slated with about 36% of the vote, according to the latest Gallup poll. So
does anybody have, you know, any power to sort of stop him doing this? Or is it, you know, if you're leader, you're just going to do what you want?
In Nicaragua, I would say that there's not really much that anyone can do to stop it. The Supreme Court has come out to say that anyone who tries to stop them from overturning this law will be deemed unconstitutional, which is kind of ironic. But the Congress in Nicaragua was looking to stop the overturn on this article.
Okay, so but it's not necessarily clear-cut that he's just immediately going to get away with it then.
No, he is. He is. Okay. He's gotten away with it. There were massive riots in the street from Sandinista supporters.
Okay.
And, yeah.
I mean, the biggest deal at the moment, really, is it seems frequently in the press, is how international concern about what's going on in the country can lead to a country's sovereignty being invaded. Obviously, we're seeing this at the moment in Libya, but there's countless other places we can mention. I mean, what is your angle on this? What right do countries have, you know, perhaps unilaterally, as the US possibly has done, to go in there and influence what's going on?
Well, I think that the US has had a long enough history of influencing what's going on in Nicaragua with the US Marine occupation and from the 1910s to the 1930s, and then again with the Sandinista Revolution, the Contra funding from President Reagan. So I think that the US has had a kind of a long enough history in being involved in Nicaragua's affairs. Sorry?
Do you think they were right to do that?
No, I don't think they are right to do it. And in fact, there's a hearing at the World Court in which the U.S. was found guilty of human rights violations and other violations such as mining the harbors of Nicaragua. So according to justice systems, no, they had no right to do it either.
As an American, particularly studying, you know, in America, how did your peer group sort of perceive the way America acts in the world? Because in Britain and a lot of European countries, you get a lot of quite common sort of post-imperial guilt. We naturally sort of assume or have a certain sense of shame about the way that Britain or the French Empire has behaved abroad. Do Americans have this? Because perhaps the European perception is that America is quite sort of self-righteous in what it's doing. Did you find that particularly amongst your peer group?
I think it can be split. I think that there are certain demographics in the United States that are, in a sense, self-righteous and do fully support whatever the U.S. chooses to undertake. But I think that in my particular peer group and the group that I went to Nicaragua with, we were really surprised at how the U.S. acted, in a sense, or and how they became involved. Because when they were involved in Nicaragua, it wasn't only Nicaragua. They were also involved in kind of coups in El Salvador and Guatemala at the same time. So it's kind of a regional thing. And yeah, it's almost a sense of shock and a little bit of embarrassment. But I think that you have to take into consideration, too, the whole idea of, you know, the communist scare in the United States at the time. And I think a lot of people were kind of on high alert, yeah, if that makes sense.
I mean, some people may know a bit about, you know, the death squads in Nicaragua and the Sandinistas, but what became of them?
What became of them? Well, the Sandinistas are now in power. The FSLN is now the current government that's in power in Nicaragua. And after the Contra War, which is the U.S.-funded war against the Sandinistas in the United States, a new president was elected, and that was kind of on behalf of U.S. pressure. And after that, like, all the kind of tension quelled a little bit, and then now Ortega's back in power, and the U.S. is supportive of him so long as there's no really any kind of human rights violations.
Okay. I mean, how about democratic uprisings? I mean, obviously different continents, but there's a lot going on in North Africa at the moment. And we are told the internet is a global phenomenon now. And is there any signs of another democratic uprising to come? What is the situation there now, is it?
In Nicaragua?
Yeah, in Nicaragua.
Well, when the people were told that there was a possibility that Ortega would not be able to run for a second term, there was a lot of violence uprising in the streets. And so that was kind of met with backing down of the Congress, I guess, in a sense, to say, okay, well, if that's what the majority wants, then we'll back off and let it happen. So, no, I don't think anytime soon in Nicaragua that will happen.
Okay. What are you sort of finishing up then? Where are you going next? Are you going to carry on studying?
Yes, I'm going to carry on studying. I recently returned from Costa Rica, where I spent a year abroad on a Fulbright research grant doing research on women's cooperatives and how they leverage the ecotourist industry in Costa Rica. And then going on to Oxford, I think, to continue studying gender and development in Latin America.
Okay. Were you encouraged by anything that happened on Women's Day or International Women's Day? I mean, it might seems a bit of a pointless cause to some in the UK, but of course, in abroad, it's massively important.
Oh, it's massive, yeah. And Blink actually had a great International Women's Day celebration at La Ruca Cafe with a fair trade coffee producer from Nicaragua and a speaker from the Venezuelan embassy. And yeah, I think women need that day in order to show their solidarity around the world.
Okay, how can people find out more about Blink if they're interested?
You can go to our website, which is www.bristolnicaragua.wordpress.com.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Jessica Randall, and hopefully we might hear more from you in the future.
Thank you.
With us in the studio today, we have Nikki Stitch, a local musician. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, you're right. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for joining us. So, tell us about your music.
I've just moved from Swansea to Bristol because I thought there'd be better musical venues for my kind of music, where people could sit down and listen to heartfelt words rather than be drunk and falling around the place like you do get in Swansea. So I'm here and I'd like to get some gigs and meet fellow musicians to jam with and see where it goes.
So what's your style of music?
I'd say it is mellow folk, indie slash folk. And I'm playing with a cellist at the moment I've just met called Ailsa Myhews, and she's Welsh as well. And looking for other musicians, like a violinist would be nice and a bassist, but we'll see where it goes. I'm always on my own busking at the moment.
Getting a merry band together is the plan then.
Yeah, on the bandwagon.
Indeed. So what would you say your kind of main influences are?
Pink Floyd, Tom Petty, Eddie Vedder, Martha Tilston, and a band from Sheffield, Pocket Satellite. They're just up and coming at the moment.
Not heard of them before.
No.
They sound pretty interesting, though.
Yeah, they're great. Like, yeah.
So when you kind of decided to move to Bristol, I presume did a reconnaissance mission to kind of work out the Bristol scene. So what's your opinion?
I love it. It's really nice, yeah. There's loads of funky venues, loads of artists and like-minded people.
Yeah. Are there lots of people who do your kind of music as well?
I haven't met anyone who does my kind of music, really. I don't know how to class my music.
So you're going to be playing a song for us later, but have you got any kind of gigs or events coming up that where people can actually hear your stuff?
In the Tally on the 17th of April, Sunday the 17th, in the Tally in Totterdown, I'll be playing with Ailsa Myhews and her boyfriend on the violin.
That's a fantastic venue. I don't know if you've been before.
Oh, they've got lovely food, really nice food.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So if people want to find out more, you're going to be playing for a song with in a second, but do you have a website that people can go to?
I'm on Facebook and MySpace, and you can listen to my music on www.myspace.com/Nikki Stitch.
Fantastic.
And yeah, there's another gig as well in Cardiff in a Norwegian church on the 24th of May. So that's all local musicians from Swansea, and there's a musician from Sweden coming down.
Brilliant.
A Welsh tour.
So what are you going to play for us now?
I'm going to sing a heartfelt song called They Take It All.
They take out trees. Trees are there to help us breathe. Take our money designed to make us grieve. Take our dreams or try to, and they'll do if they think they can. And
That was They Take It All by Nikki Stitch, and you can hear more of her music at www.myspace.com/Nikki Stitch, and that Nikki is N-I-K-I. If you'd like to hear more from Nikki in person, she's playing at the Tali Totterdown on the 17th of April.
Last week, we heard an interview with a former soldier from El Salvador about the ongoing violence prevalent today in Central America as a direct legacy of long civil wars in the area, 36 years in Guatemala and 20 years in El Salvador. This week in part two, we hear about the gangs ruling the countries today. During the era of the civil wars, many orphans were taken into the gangs. Later, when civil wars finally ended, these young men went to America to find the American dream. Spurned by their fellow countrymen in the USA, they formed themselves into gangs, notably in Los Angeles, where they were known as the Maras. The American government, because of the violence perpetrated by these gangs, eventually sent them back to Central America, where the gangs, mainly in the big cities, formed themselves into no-go areas, usually called after the number of streets where they had lived in Los Angeles, for example, Maras 18 or Maras 12. In the second part of this interview, we hear about the way in which gangs operate and how much control they exercise over the country and the civilian population. The music you hear comes from Guatemala and is called Danza de los Guacamayas from the CD El Parbunk suite, Indígena Folclórica.
I'm in a restaurant in Antigua, in Guatemala, and you're from El Salvador.
I am from El Salvador, and I was involved in a civil war several years ago.
So how old were you when the civil war started?
I was about 17 or 16 years old. And so they started these gangs in El Salvador. At the moment, if I'm not wrong, there are about 100,000 people involved in the Maras in El Salvador, but they are also in Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and probably in Costa Rica.
Is it just in the big cities that the problems occur?
Mostly in the big cities, where they can get anything. They can sell anything, they can do anything. If they control an area in any city, you cannot go through. If you want to go through, you can be injured or you can be beat, or you have to pay to go through their areas.
So why don't the police put a stop to it?
It is a huge problem in all Central America. The police cannot control them, and many policemen are involved with them. They control everything. Everything. When I mean everything, I mean everything. They control big areas, a lot of people. They control drugs. They control many things. It is amazing how they are involved in a lot of things.
So do they teach their children to become involved as well? Do they pass it on to the children?
Yes, they do. For instance, it is a big deal to be in a gang. For them, it's a dream to be involved with them. All the kids want to be involved with the gangs. And they start working for them, doing small things. When they are big enough, they can be accepted in the gang. but they have to do something. They have to kill someone or put, I don't know, bombs in a certain place, which is controlled for another gang, or they can be beaten for all the people who is involved in the Mara. If they survive, they can be a part of the Mara.
How on earth is this situation ever going to be resolved?
I cannot see any solution in the near future, because, as I said before, many people from the government or from the authorities are involved with them. They have a big, big power.
So what about the students here? Do they have any influence over what's happening?
The only thing that I can see that can stop them is if they change their own minds, can say their own heart, because they don't respect anybody or anything. The only possible change has to be a change into the deepest part of their hearts.
When you talk about these people, are they indigenous people mainly, or are they Spanish descendants?
They are mostly from El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, but they are natives. They are not involved with different countries, just in between them.
But are they from the Indian descent or Spanish?
Okay.
Or is it mixed?
Okay. It is a good question, because in El Salvador we have no natives. All of us are descendant of Spanish, mixed up with the people who was living hundreds of years ago in El Salvador.
So it's mixed race?
Yes, it's not a pure race if you can see it that way. In Guatemala, for instance, the 75% are natives, I mean indigenous. So many of them are involved in the gangs. In Nicaragua, for instance, there are not so much natives, but the people who is involved with the gangs are, we are mixed, not pure natives. Same in Honduras. Mostly in Guatemala are natives, because they have the 75% of the population indigenous, you know what I mean?
What about the women they marry? Don't they object to all this or not, or are they coerced into it?
It is a very good question. For instance, a girl who belongs to Amara can have a boyfriend, but to get accepted in the Mara, she has to lay down with all the guys who are in the Mara. For instance, 25 or 15 guys at one.
So she has to, with the rest of the gang?
She has to, if she wants to be accepted. She's like an object, not a person. All the people who is involved with the Mara are instruments. They are not any longer treated like humans.
What about the tourists? Do they attack tourists or not?
If, for accident, a tourist get crossing across to an area who is dominated by Amara, he could die, at least. If she's a girl, she can be violated repeatedly or dead.
Where is this, in Guatemala City, the big cities, or in El Salvador?
What the government does is they warn the tourists to avoid to go across these areas.
Ruled by the Maras?
Yes. For instance, if I go into an area controlled by them, I can die. There is no any guarantee.
What, would they shoot you?
They can shoot you, or they can beat you, or they can stab you. Depends on their way to act. Every gang has its own brand, you know. They, for instance, cut the head of the people who is trying to do anything bad against them. Or if I say to the police, hey, look, this guy is belonging to Mara and he is giving us problems. If they know about it, I can be killed. And they do it in a very bad way, like a warning to any other people who could think about, tell anything about them.
So it's fear.
Of course. They fear all the people. They live by fear. So if I am afraid about them, I will not tell anything and they will grow up. Everything is linked.
Is it bad in Guatemala City? Is it as bad here? Because there's quite a few tourists here, aren't there?
It is dangerous. Any country you go and if there are maras, it is dangerous. You never know when you face them. Because they operate in certain areas, there are a lot of different gangs. There is no big bus ruling all the maras. Every mara has its own rules and its own people in charge. They are not related one to another, or at least not all of them.
In Guatemala City, which are the worst zones then for the maras?
I don't know.
But what about the rest of Guatemala? Is it safe to travel around the rest of the country?
It is safe to travel across the country, but it is not safe to travel for accident through the areas they control. They have areas, always they have areas. And they don't go outside the areas because they can get into a different area controlled for a different mara. And if they do so, they have to fight and they kill themselves. And they have no mercy from one mara to a different mara. They cannot see each other. They kill themselves, always.
What about Belize and Honduras?
Honduras is suffering the same problems than Guatemala and Nicaragua. El Salvador is worst. Belize, I don't know, I don't think so, because they are a different kind of people. They are African-Americans, mostly. They don't act the same than our people. It was a British colony, and they have different culture. It is matter mostly of culture in Central America.
Is there anything else you want to add to that?
I think I have told a lot. I heard about a guy who wrote a book mentioning how the Mara act, how do they do everything, and after a year he was published his book. He was killed by the Maras. So it is dangerous to talk about this issue.
Conflicts. The music that you heard was called Danza Celas Guacameas, and it comes from the CD El Pabanc Suite. Pabanc is spelled P-A-A-B-A-N-C. The CD El Pabanc Suite, Indigena Folklorica. And now, here is Alec Milne to read the 12th part of the Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest McHugh. The music is Duff, performed by Concerto Caledonia.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 12. Pacific Voyages, the Cruise of the Equator. Samoa and Sydney, Cruise of the Janet Nicol. The Equator sailed from Honolulu on the 24th of June 1889. Balfour described the departure. At the last moment, two fine carriages drove down at full speed to the wharf and there deposited King Kalakaua and a party of his native musicians. There was but a minute for goodbye and a parting glass of champagne. The king returned to the shore and stood there waving his hand, while from the musicians lined up at the very edge of the wharf came the tender strains of a farewell. The Pygmy trading schooner of 62 tons register, under the command of Captain Denny Reed, characterised by Fanny as a small, fiery Scotch-Irishman, full of amusing eccentricities and always a most gay and charming companion, spent the next 6 months voyaging through the Gilbert Islands, southwards towards Samoa. The Gilbert Islands, formerly also known as Kingsmill Group and now called Kiribati, form a chain of some 16 small, low-lying coral islands and atolls situated very close to the equator. At this time, they were still governed by native kings or chiefs and were little visited save by trading vessels. Stevenson and his party spent two considerable periods ashore. The first of these was at Butaritari, where the equator arrived on the 13th July, where the Stevensons lived in the White Man compound for over a month, passing their evenings in the Sans Souci bar, owned by Adolf Rick, a Prussian who had lived at Butaritari for 9 years as manager of the Whiteman Brothers trading store. From Butaritari, the equator travelled to Apaiang and thence to Apanama, where the Stevensons made their second considerable stay ashore. RLS's own very full account of his experiences at both places is given in parts 4 and 5 of In the South Seas. To Sidney Colvin, 22nd August 1889, Schooner Equator, Apaiang Lagoon. My dear Colvin, the missionary ship is outside the reef, trying vainly to get in, so I may have a chance to get a line off. I'm glad to say I shall be home by June next for the summer, or we shall know the reason why. For God's sake, be well and jolly for the meeting. I shall be, I believe, a different character from what you have seen this long while. This cruise is, up to now, a huge success, being interesting, pleasant and profitable. The beachcomber is perhaps the most interesting character here. The natives are very different, on the whole, from Polynesians. They are moral, standoffish, for good reasons, and protected by a dark tongue. It's delightful to meet the Hawaiians, mostly missionaries, that are dotted about, with their Italian brio and their ready friendliness. The whites are a strange lot. Many of them good, kind, pleasant fellows, others quite the lowest I have ever seen from the slums of cities. I wish I had time to narrate to you the doings and character of three white murderers, more or less proven, I have met. One, the only undoubted assassin of the lot, quite gained my affection in his big home out of a wreck, with his New Hebrides wife, with her savage turban of hair, and yet a perfect lady, and his three adorable little girls in Rob Roy MacGregor dresses, dancing to the hand organ, performing circus on the floor with startling effect of nudity, and curling up together on a mat to sleep. Three sizes, three attitudes, three Rob Roy dresses, and six little clenched fists, the murderer meanwhile brooding and gloating over his chicks, till your heart went out to him. And yet his crime, on the face of it, was dark, disemboweling, in his own house, a man of 70, and him drunk. It is lunchtime, I see, and I must close up with my warmest love to you. I wish you were here to sit upon me when required. Ah, if only you were but a good sailor. I will never leave the sea, I think. It is only there that a Briton lives. My poor grandfather, it is from him I inherit the taste, I fancy, and he was around many islands in his day. But I, please God, shall beat him at that before the recall is sounded. Would you be surprised to learn that I have contemplated becoming a shipowner? I do, but it is a secret. Life is far better fun than people dream who fall asleep among the chimney stacks and telegraph wires. Ever yours, my dear fellow, Robert Louis Stevenson. to his mother, schooner Equator at sea, 240 miles from Samoa. Sunday, 1 December, 1889. My dear mother, we are drawing, we fondly hope, to a close of another voyage, like that from Tahiti to Hawaii. We sailed from Butaritari on the 4th November. Since then we have lain becalmed under cataracts of rain, or kicked about in purposeless squalls. We were 16 souls in this small schooner, 11 in the cabin, our confinement and overcrowding in the wet weather were excessive. We lost our fore topmast in a squall, the sails were continually being patched, we had but one suit. And, with all attention, we lost the jib topsail almost entirely, and staysail and mainsail are far through. To complete the discomfort, we have carried a very wild weather glass. A daily fall of 15 hundredths in 4 hours, followed by a corresponding rise. And, on one occasion, accompanied by the fall of the thermometer to 79 degrees at noon, kept us on the qui vive. I wonder, are you already so far out of key with the South Seas that 79 degrees at noon will seem warm to you? You should have seen the greatcoats out. I myself wore 2 woollen undershirts, a knitted waistcoat, the gift of the King of Upanama, and a flannel blazer, and I was seriously thinking of a flannel shirt when the cold let up. My birthday was a great event. Mr. Rick, the agent of the firm in Butaritari, who makes on this trip one of 11 beings in the cabin, had his on the 12th, so we had 2 days' festivities. Champagne, music, the capture of sharks, dolphins, and a skipjack, mighty welcome additions to our table. Ah Fu, at my elbow, the tradesman door, begs me to add that 2 little land birds joined the ship and stayed for 20 hours. The log says, 13th, throughout the day, dead calm with heavy rain, sometimes light westerly airs, and very strong easterly current. Of course, we had no observation, but our position next day was 179 degrees 35 minutes east, 6 degrees 58 north. On the evening of my birthday, all hands came into the cabin to make me a compliment. The long American sailor, called the Fisherman's Child after a doleful ditty that he sings, was at the wheel, compared Tatuma, tall, powerful Hawaiian, about 20, Te Tau, Apayang Islander, perhaps 13, Charlie South, San Francisco, of Scottish descent, and very like our Agnes, 15, La Honolulu Stowaways, perhaps 13, Georgie called George Muggery Bar, Esquire, Hawaiian, the ship's infant age, perhaps 9, his little jacket shrunk up almost to his nipples, his little breeches, once they were his trousers, leaving bare his knees below and part of his hips above. How they stayed on, nobody can guess. Both Marines of the afterguard were at the table, Fanny, Lloyd, Joe and I, Captain Dennis Reed, Greenock, 25, Adolf Rick, Galician, born in Prussia, 43, Paul Leonard, 28, Prussian, known as the passenger of Mariki, towards which island, like a will-o'-the-wisp, he has been sailing in this equator for 9 weeks, and will sail at least half as many more. And yet, he has twice sighted it, and yet the wind failed, and the westerly current took charge, and farewell, Mariki! Tom Thompson, but his name is Old Somethingson, Norwegian, our mate, the tavern keeper of Mariki 30. In the background, our cook and steward, the great Ah Fu, Sana China, and Mary McCallum, son of the Freekirk minister on the Clyde. Mr. Swan has been to his father's house, aged about 20, to his congregations, the small lamp-lighted tossing cabin, 9 foot square, with the compass and the binnacle and lantern inside on a bracket on the after bulkhead, and the steersman looking down at us through an eye-shaped aperture, like an arrow loophole. At the incessant roar of the tropic rain, the dripping leaks, the slush in the floor, and the general sense that we were nowhere in particular and drifting anywhere at large, and there is my 39th birthday. Charlie South was a spokesman of the crew and made a neat little speech of a sentence, and you should have seen the row of brown faces. Fanny has stood the hardships of this rough cruise wonderfully, but I do not think I should expose her to another of the same. I have been first rate, though I am now done for lack of green food. Joe is, I fear, really ill, and Lloyd has bad sores on his legs. We shall send Joe on to Sydney by the first steamer, and Elle, Fanny and I shall stay on a while, time being quite vague, in Samoa. Write to Sydney. We shall turn up in England by May or June. Your ever affectionate son, R.L.S.
Thank you very much to Alec Milner for reading the selected letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest McHugh. Eagerly eared listeners who have been paying attention will no doubt be waiting for a poem written by a certain Minnie Haskins, who had her poem read out by the King, no less. That will be coming up after our Poetry Corner. It's time to welcome Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi.
What has been in your mind this week?
Well, this is a piece. I watched all the coverage in the telly about the tsunami in Japan, and it was just kind of overwhelming, and I tried to write something about that. And This is dedicated to all the people who lost all their relatives, and just so I hope it matches up to the terrible event. When the earth moved, skyscrapers wobbled like boxes. People scattered like dust. Water rose like a mountain, became a wall of death, tossed ships like toys, crushed cars like tins, drowned people like ants, smashed houses like matchboxes. A nation watched its coastline disappear under a smashing tide, so high it covered roofs, then buried all beneath the valley of flotsam. People returned unable to recognize their homes, unable to locate familiar sites as the water mountain had pounded them into mulch, pummeling all to a mash of matchstick and papier-mâché, making a midget of man a mangle of all his technology.
Thank you. Very sombre topic, but very relevant. And no doubt they will continue to have a lot of problems long after the media have got bored of reporting it.
Definitely, yeah.
Tim Burrows, thank you.
Thanks a lot, John.
God Knows by Minnie Louise Haskins, otherwise known as The Gate of the Year, was published in 1908 and was part of a collection entitled The Desert. It caught the public attention and the popular imagination when Queen Elizabeth handed a copy to her husband, King George VI, and he quoted it in his 1939 Christmas broadcast to the British Empire. So this is God Knows. And I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, "Give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown." And he replied, "Go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way." So I went forth, and finding the hand of God, trod gladly into the night, and he led me towards the hills and the breaking of the day in the lone east. So heart be still, what need our little life, our human life to know, if God hath comprehension? In all the dizzy strife of things both high and low, God hideth his intention. God knows, his will is best. The stretch of years which wind ahead so dim to our imperfect vision are clear to God. Our fears are premature. In him all time hath full provision. Then rest, until God moves to lift the veil from our impatient eyes, when, as the sweeter features of life's stern face we hail, fair beyond all surmise, God's thoughts around his creatures our mind shall fill.
Our regular poetry contributors, Tim Burrows and Trevor Carter, are contributing to a night of poetry and film. It's taking place on Tuesday, the 5th of April, 7:30 in the evening, at the Pierian Centre, which is in Portland Square in St. Paul's. Also featured are Charles Thompson, David Johnson and Diana Taylor. Diana Taylor has made some award-winning poetry films. They're complemented by live performances from the poets themselves this evening. So it's sort of an evening of evocative, crafted, award-winning films. If that sounds like your kind of thing, tickets cost £7.50 entry. Concessions are available. And they must be booked on 0117 924 4512. Or you can email the Pierian Centre, info@pieriancentre.com. So I'll spell Pierian for you, obviously. P-I-E-R, as in a pier, I-A-N, Pierian. info@pieriancentre.com, and you'll be able to find out more. Freshly resplendent in a Guinness shirt, here is Jeff with the What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 8th of April, G Baby I Love You will be performing with support from the Solvents at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Saturday, 9th of April, Kinks Controversy will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Michael Munro. The former Hanoi Rocks vocalist in 2010 unveiled his new band, which features Sammy Yaffa of Hanoi Rocks, Ginger from the Wild Hearts, Steve Conte from New York Dolls, and Carl Roskvist from Danzig. This is from the album Sensory Overdrive, which was released this year, and is a track titled All You Need.
From the start I was a smart ass kid. Nothing much I haven't tried and did. I used to think I was the center of it all, until reality called. I used to worry about the money coming in. Now I stick it in the charity bin. I used to whine and I used to complain, but well, we've all seen a little rain. Take a look at the life you lead. What you got is all you need. The blind lead and the blind.
Michael Munro with the track All You Need from the album Sensory Overdrive. He will be on tour in April and playing the O2 Academy in Bristol on 5th of April. Continuing with Saturday 9th of April, Soul Destroyers will be performing at Fiddler's in Railway Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 10th of April, Flash Harry will be performing at Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all for this week. Time's up. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 93.2 at 12 noon every Sunday. We're also broadcast on Preston FM, and also in St Albans on Radio Verulam.
If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download the weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find a lo-fi mono version of Dialect for dial-up connections at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. Thank you to our studio guests, Nikki Stitch and Jessica Randall, and thank you to Tim Burrows and Jeff Sparks for the contributions, and also to Tony Gosling for his Kingswood-based contribution to the show. Studio production was by Michael Noyce, and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find also on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. From all the team in Queen Square Studio and Bristol City Centre, thank you very much.
That's the news now. The shipping forecast issued by the Met Office at 0505 today, Saturday the 27th of September. The general synopsis at 0100, low Norway 1005, expected Baltic 1001 by 0100 tomorrow.
New low expected Dover 1015 by same time. Low southwest Fitzroy 1018, moving southeast and losing its identity. With the winds to western grounds, riding the way for 5, initially 6 across the east, there 3 or 4, showers, good. North 0, north 5, 6, increasing 3, showers, good. South 0, northwest 5, 7,